They discussed the calculators at Merton, and the death of Abbot Richard of Wallingford, who had invented a new triangular geometry, and an instrument, the rectangulus, much favored by navigators. And to speak of navigators, Dietrich added, the Spanish have discovered new islands in the ocean sea. He had the tale from Tarkan, who had it in turn from his master's agents. They lie off the coast of Africa and boast great flocks of canaries. So it may be that a new way across ocean may be found, leading to the oversea lands on Bacon's map. One may more easily explain Bacon's land by a cartographer's imagination and the lure of blank spaces. Occam smiled and added, much as your rustic woodcarvers here have filled in the walls of your church with giant grasshoppers and the like. Joachim had a slice of pumpernickel in his mouth and nearly choked, until Dietrich had helped him to swallow some ale to help it down. Occam rose, saying, I'll fetch more ale from the kitchen. But Joachim gasped, no, there waits also a giant grasshopper. Unsure of the jest, Occam barked, puzzled laughter. 19. June, 1349. At Nonis, the commemoration of Bernard of Menthon. Manfred styled his banquet a symposium, and promised a quadlibet between Dietrich and Occam as the postprandial entertainment. But as some entertainments were not to everyone's taste, this did not supplant Peter's singing, or the dwarf's acrobatics, or the juggler's display of plates and knives. The dwarf's trained dog drew but a pursed lip from Will Occam, but Kunigund and Eugen laughed hugely, especially when the dog tugged the dwarf's hose down to reveal his bare ass. Einhard, like Manfred, paid more particular attention to the singing. Einhard has held me ill, Manfred had confided earlier to Dietrich, for missing the Bohort, so this is my peace to him. Dietrich, having verified the knight's famous stink, gave thanks that his corpulent wife, Lady Rosamond, sat between them. The sideboard was laden with game birds and aged venison, and continually refreshed by a never-ceasing bustle of servants bearing platters, retrieving empty trenchers, and spreading on the floor fresh rushes mixed with flowers to surrender their scents when stepped upon. Behind each seat a page awaited the diner's every need. Tarkan Ben Beck, brushed and combed into respectability, did service for his master, for Malachi's rites did not permit him to eat of Manfred's bounty, but only of his own provisions, prepared under his supervision. Normally two of Manfred's hounds would prowl the room, scavenging scraps that fell from the table, but from respect for the Jew's sensibilities the animals had been barred from the feast. Their piteous howling could be heard faintly from the kennels outside. Eugen sat at Manfred's right and Kunigund his left. Beside them were Dietrich and Will, with Malachi the Jew to Will's right. Malachi's wife and daughter remained in seclusion, disappointing Eugen, who had anticipated the exotic sight of veiled women. Lady Rosamond was hardly compensation. To Einhard's left, at the table's foot, sat Thierry von Hintervoltkopf. The knight had already delivered his required service days, but Manfred hoped to induce him to serve additional days from love, to help hunt the outlaws. In the corner, beside the fireplace, Peter Minnesinger sat with his two assistants. "If it please, mein Herr," he said, twisting his strings until they sang true, "I would sing from Parzival."
"Not that horrid French tale," Einhard complained.
"No, Lord Knight," Peter draped his hair and settled the lute upon his lap. "I would sing Wolfram von Eschenbach's version, which all men know is the noblest rendition of the story."
Manfred waved a hand. "Something less weighty," he said, "something touching love. Play Falcon's song."
A devotee of the new art, Peter oft complained of Manfred's fondness for the old-fashioned minnesong, in which all was figure and symbol, and would have preferred a more modern lyric in which real people moved through real landscapes. Falconsong was, however, artfully constructed, and no line could be changed without spoiling its symmetry. Its author, anonymous, as poets of olden days often were, was known only as He of Gurenberg. I raised me a falcon for more than a year, when I had him tamed as I'd have him be, and I'd dressed his feathers with rich golden bands. Aloft high he soared, and flew to other lands. Since then have I seen him gracefully flying, sporting upon his foot silken tyings, and his coat of feathers glittered golden. May God bring together who would lovers remain. Listening, Dietrich marveled at how God could appear in sudden and unexpected places, for Falkensong had given him God's answer to the problem of Ilse and Gerd. It mattered not that Ilse had been baptized and Gerd had not, for God would bring lovers together. And more than lovers. Had Dietrich not raised Theresia as he'd have her be? Had she not flown to other lands? Had he not seen her since gracefully flying? Surely God would bring them together once again. A tear wound its way down his cheek, and Kunigund, ever attentive to those about her, noticed and placed her hand on his. Afterward, amid the clatter of silverware and Krautstrung's, table talk settled on matters of the world. The house of Bardi had followed the house of Peruzzi into insolvency, Occam told them, and Malachi added that silver had become scarce.
It is all going east to the Sultan to pay for silk and spices.
Dietrich said, in his tractate on money that mein Herr gave me, young Oresme wrote that money can be understood just as the rainbow or magnetism. He states that if the prince sets a ratio on the coins that differs from the values of silver to gold in the market, the underrated coin will vanish from circulation and the overrated alone remains current.
A philosophy of money, said Occam. Silver does buy more gold in the East, Malachi said, tugging his beard.
So it flies to other lands, laughed Kunigund.
May God not keep silver asunder from those who love it, added Thierry with a sly glance at the Jew. Bah, said Einhard. Then the prince merely fixes the prices of silver and gold in the market to match the values he sets on the coin.
Perhaps not, Dietrich replied.
Jean Olivier argued that a thing's price derives from the assessments of those who seek to buy it, regardless of what merchants demand or princes decree, or however much labor went into its making. Occam laughed. It's Buridan's wicked influence. Oresme was his pupil, as was Brother Angelus here. He nodded to Dietrich. And another from Saxony, called Little Albert, is already much talked of. Ah, Dietl. You should have stayed at Paris. They would speak of you in the same way.
I leave fame for others, Dietrich answered curtly.
When talk turned later to politics, Occam recounted the infamous progress of the Wittelsbach court through Italy 20 years before, when they had burned the Pope in effigy. After all, he said, what say has a Frenchman in the election of the Roman Kaiser? Chavot, said Einhard, saluting with his cup. I had thought to use this as the topic for the disputation, said Manfred, gesturing with a haunch of venison for the wine to be poured. Tell us your arguments, Brother Occam, if they are not merely that you ate at Ludwig's table.
Occam rested his chin on his palm and curled one finger by his ear.
Mein Herr, he said after a moment, Marsilio wrote that no one could gainsay the prince in his own land. Of course he meant that Jacques de Cahors could not gainsay Ludwig, which pleased Ludwig greatly. And what he really meant was that he was a Ghibelline, and blamed the Pope for every ill in Italy. Ghibelline, said Einhard. Why cannot the Italians pronounce Wibbelgen?
Manfred studied the back of his hand.
And you did not agree.
Occam spoke cautiously.
I argued that in extremis, and if the prince is becoming a tyrant, then it is legitimate for another prince, or even a pope, to invade his country and overthrow him.
Einhard expelled his breath, and Thierry stiffened. Even Manfred grew still. As the Breisgau lords, Dietrich interjected quickly, overthrew von Falkenstein.
Einhard grunted. Outlaws? Ah!
The sudden tension eased. Manfred cast Dietrich an amused glance. He tossed the bone of his venison to the floor and turned again to Occam.
"And how are we to know when the prince has become a tyrant?"
Occam's page refilled the Englishman's krautstrunk, and Occam took a swallow before answering.
"You have heard the maxim, what has pleased the prince has the force of law? But I gloss that. What pleases the prince reasonably and justly for the sake of the common good has the force of law."
Manfred studied his guest carefully and rubbed his cheek.
"The prince," he said, "has always in mind the common good."
Occam nodded.
"Naturally, a prince who rules with God's law in his heart will do so. But men are sinners, and princes are men. So, men have certain natural rights directly from God, which the prince may not alienate. The first such, a man has the right to his own life."
Eugen gestured with his knife. "But he may be murdered by an enemy, or fall to the pest, or other injury. What right to life has a man drowning in a river?"
Occam raised his forefinger. "That a man possesses a natural right to his own life means only that his defense of that life is legitimate, not that his defense will be successful."
He spread his hands.
"As for other natural rights, I number the right to freedom against tyranny, and the right to property. That last he may forgo when in doing so he pursues his own happiness."
Occam cut into a sausage set before him by a page.
"As the spiritualists do in imitation of the poverty of the Lord and his apostles."
Thierry laughed.
"Good. That leaves more for the rest of us."
Occam waved a dismissal.
"But with Ludwig dead, every man must look to himself, so I am for Avignon to make my peace with Clement.
This really is a most excellent sausage."